Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, Ambassador Mary Kramer will be my guest, formerly of the Iowa Senate. She'll talk about her report on improving work culture at the Iowa State House, that coming up in our second half hour. But first of all, perhaps you're one of the tens of thousands of drivers in Iowa who's been nabbed by a traffic camera. You get this nice little photo of yourself, your car, and a fine in the mail to pay for speeding. Traffic cameras, though, have fallen out of favor, at least with many Iowa lawmakers. Last week, the Iowa House Local Government Committee approved a total ban on automated traffic enforcement devices. The Republican majority approved the House study bill. It sends it to the full House for consideration. And this bill would reach into local governing in Iowa, voiding all local ordinances authorizing the use of traffic cameras as of July 1st and order their removal in the 8 cities and 1 county where they are used in the state. Now, just a moment, we're going to talk with 2 Iowa lawmakers, Brad Zahn and Bobby Kaufman, and also Paul Parisik of the Des Moines Police Department about the issue. But first, let's get some background from Brian Morelli, Gazette reporter, who's been over years looking into this issue. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ben. How's it going?
It's going fine. So remind us, take us back to how this all started. Cedar Rapids is one of the areas well known in the state, that S-curve that curves by Quaker Oats, the U.S. Cellular Center, a particularly dangerous sort of S-curve there, and this was sort of where it started in the Cedar Rapids area?
Yeah, Cedar Rapids was one of the first to put up the cameras, and the argument was that it was, you know, the S-curve was risky. They needed a way to kind of get people to slow down. So back in 2010, they put up the cameras, and the ones in Cedar Rapids, particularly the ones on 380, are the most prolific in the state. I think that they've made well over $20 million, hundreds of thousands of tickets over the lifespan of the cameras. Mm-hmm. So flash forward, you know, the debates going on whether these are about safety or about, you know, making money. That's kind of the two sides, and they're both very passionate in their arguments. But in late 2013, early 2014, the DOT went through a process to create some new administrative rules to govern the cameras, because there really wasn't any kind of rules in place other than local ordinances. And so they create these rules and also a review process where every year the cities that use the cameras have to basically justify the continued use of the cameras to show, you know, they actually are making a difference in safety.
Can that be documented? Has that in Cedar Rapids' case?
Well, in Cedar Rapids, the number that they pointed to the most, crashes, the most serious crashes had gone down, and also there hadn't been any fatalities in like the first 5 or 6 years. So that was, you know, some strong evidence where, you know, the people, particularly police, were saying, hey, look, these cameras are making a difference. And on the flip side, you talk to some others and say, hey, there's a number of other factors. They put on some, you know, traction surface to help slow people down. You know, so it's kind of, you know, there's two sides of that argument as well.
Right, Brian. But as people know who frequent that corridor, that stretch, the stretch of 380 that winds through Cedar Rapids, you know, when the traffic cameras were there, the traffic was going just at the speed limit. You really went above the speed limit at your own peril, even though there are some tolerances built into this. And now, without the traffic cameras there, I easily notice that the people are stepping on the gas again, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I drive it daily, and I would totally agree that speeds are up. But on the flip side, and I've done some reporting on this, mm-hmm. that, you know, you don't have the stop and go, because everyone knows where the cameras are who drives it regularly. You get people jamming on their brakes when you see the cameras coming, and you speed right up when you go past it. And so there's this sort of herky-jerky flow to the traffic patterns, mm-hmm. that, you know, and so with that gone, some people say, hey, it actually feels, you know, yeah, people are going faster, but it feels a little bit safer. And at least a report I did last fall found that crashes were actually down with the cameras off. According to DOT data, the city's data was a little bit, showed it down, but less dramatically.
Right. This is something that pits local authorities against the Capitol, the legislature. Talk, though, also about how the Iowa Supreme Court is part of this. They have some cases to do with this.
Yeah, so I guess one other key piece in the timeline is in March 2005 or 2015, the DOT ordered several of the cameras around the state, including the ones on the S-curve in Cedar Rapids, to be turned off or moved. And so some of the cities, Des Moines, Muscatine, Cedar Rapids, appealed, and they lost their appeal at the district court level. They took it and they appealed again to the district court. To the Iowa Supreme Court, and that's where it's at now. It's a pending case. Some people are expecting some kind of ruling later in the spring, and to find out, you know, where it comes down. And the key, I guess, some of the key arguments in the case are whether, you know, home rule versus the state administrative rule. You know, the cities had argued that it doesn't pass the logic factor. Like, why would you take down these cameras that promote safety, you know, and take them out, and then the roads would be less safe. The DOT has sort of said, well, it's actually the reasons we created these rules are because people had concerns that they were, you know, for example, the, you know, placing speed cameras right after a speed limit change. You know, they said that didn't, you know, pass the logic test. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay. Brian, we'll look forward to see how the Supreme Court case turns out. Thanks for the getting us up to date and speed cameras, how it looks in the Cedar Rapids area. Are there any speed cameras operating now in that area?
Cedar Rapids, they're all turned off. They're collecting data right now, but they're not issuing tickets in Cedar Rapids. I believe you'd have to double check. I believe the other cameras around the state that were ordered off have also been turned off. And this is by the judge had ordered them to be turned off.
Okay, Brian Morelli, Gazette reporter. Thanks very much for the update, Brian.
Thanks. Okay.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News this half hour, talking about how the how many lawmakers are trying to put the brakes, whatever motorist metaphor you want to use, giving it a red light, these red light cameras. The Republican majority approved a House study bill that would be a total ban on automated traffic enforcement devices. Perhaps you have them in your community or a place where you frequently drive. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Joining us now from the State House Law Library, Senator Brad Zaughn is with us. He represents Senator from the Des Moines area, Representative Bobby Kaufman as well from Muscatine, and of the Des Moines Police Department, Police Sergeant Paul Parizic, their public information officer. Welcome to you all.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, Senator Zaughn. What is the change that you and fellow lawmakers are seeking, and why?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I have a lot of admiration for Sergeant Paul Parizic and all the police departments throughout the state of Iowa. And this bill, I want to be really clear. We expect everyone to obey the traffic laws that are in place. This is not an encouragement to do anything other than that. With that said, we've talked about this for many, many years down here. I would say what's changed the momentum in getting rid of these cameras is what Cedar Rapids just recently did, and that they hired an outside company to collect the fines that were not getting paid. And when someone would go in from the Cedar Rapids area to renew their license or their license plates, they could not do that until they paid that fine. So that tells me that this has become more about revenue than it has been about public safety. With that said, one of the cities, and like I said, I shop in Windsor Heights, it's a suburb of Des Moines, has, I believe, the most abusive situation, where you go down University and at the top of the hill there's a permanently mounted traffic enforcement camera, speed camera, and then you go down to the bottom of the hill about approximately six blocks down the hill, there's another camera. They're in a 25 mile an hour zone, which if anybody knows, familiar with University, it's a very heavily traveled city, and I give that to the cities to be able to set the speed limits. I was mayor of Urbandale, and we got involved in those issues. But it was became really abusive to the citizens. I'm a believer that you are in based on our Constitution, and this is the biggest reason why I object to these cameras, is you're innocent until proven guilty. It doesn't matter who's driving the car that gets the ticket. The person that owns a car will receive the ticket. And I just think that that's wrong. And I know that there's been some data that I saw recently when they did turn the cameras off of 380, which I always gave that area of Iowa the benefit of the doubt because that's an S-curve, and I've been told there's a lot of accidents there. But based on the data from the DOT, and then, of course, the reporter mentioned before, through the Cedar Rapids City, that their accidents have been reduced since the traffic cameras. In Clive, at the intersections that they had the red light cameras, I know that accidents increased because of those.
Okay.
I just, that's the biggest reason why I object to what these cameras are doing.
Let's go to Sergeant Perizic for a different view. How does Des Moines Police Department view the traffic cameras?
Well, I think we've always held the same position, and we're going to, you know, dig our heels in over it. It's a safety issue as far as we're concerned, and we have seen a decrease in crashes, particularly at our intersection cameras, where we specifically targeted areas where we saw high numbers of broadside crashes or right-angle crashes, where people are most likely to be seriously injured when those crashes occur, and we've seen a significant reduction in those over the years. One of the things that we have noticed with the speed cameras that, it's always going to baffle us, but every year over the past 5 years, with the exception of 2014, we've seen a significant increase in the number of citations issued. So where our goal might be voluntary compliance, the camera's not the deterrent that we would hope it to be. So I know Senator Zahn and I were talking right before we started, and he made the comment that we think this is kind of a generational thing, and I tend to agree with him. And it kind of goes along the lines with texting and driving. That's a generational thing. We had to.
So younger people are the ones more likely to speed?
I think that's the case. Again, you know, it's who the car is registered to. That's who gets the citation.
Mm-hmm.
But conversations, and it's all anecdotal, but conversations that I've had in the community, people are like, "Hey, man, I'll pay $65. That's nothing. You know, okay. I need to get where I'm going." But we do know that when we turned off the freeway camera, the Gazette reporter was right, the freeway camera in Des Moines is off. It does still collect data, and we're consistently seeing high speeds well over 100 miles an hour, and that's something that we didn't see while that camera was on. You might see that occasionally, but
and also,
speeds that higher.
I don't think you've mentioned this. I've heard this in the debate, Sergeant, is that this allows technology to do some work that would otherwise have to be done by a police officer, so you can have, when you have these speed cameras, you have more resources because the police officers can be out doing things that technology can't?
And that's true. And Des Moines is in kind of a unique circumstance, and it's nothing to do with traffic enforcement, but we're running about 30 cops short. So anything we can do to make better use of the technology that's available to us. So a lot of these intersections that we chose the red light cameras at and then the speed camera on 235 were selected because those are areas where traditional law enforcement, traditional policing, it just isn't safe or it's not practical.
Right.
With the reconstruction of 235 many years ago, we lost a lot of shoulder space, and it's just not safe to put our people out there.
Mm-hmm.
So this did help us out in that fact. You know, we were trying to work a little smarter and do more with less. Now here's where we're at. Here's the debate.
Okay, Representative Kaufman, you're from the Muscatine area. Have you had traffic cameras in the Muscatine area?
Yes, actually, Muscatine, the city of Muscatine, is a city that utilizes these cameras more so than most. And you know, I respect everything that the officer just said, and there are numerous law enforcement officers that came to our subcommittee and our committee and have reached out to me that are in total opposition, and I respect their viewpoint. But I also come at this from a law enforcement perspective, channeling my local law enforcement back home. My sheriff, Sheriff C.J. Ryan, who's as law and order as anybody you'll ever meet, has been a policeman for 23 years, is the sheriff of the county that utilizes these cameras just as much as anyone else that is the city of Muscatine. And he is vehemently and adamantly opposed to these cameras. And he comes at it from the perspective of a traffic stop is an investigation. An officer can analyze whether someone, A, has their insurance valid, a driver's license valid, whether they've been drinking, whether they're impaired, and it's an investigation. He just he does not like this automatic policing powers giving to both technology and a private company. And he's not alone. I've had several law enforcement officers, so I think this is a split issue when it comes to law enforcement.
Well, instead of relying on people, sheriffs or whoever, why not rely simply on the data? The data, Sergeant Parizic, does the data in Des Moines' case give a clear picture, or is it somewhat ambiguous when you look at the data?
Well, that's a tough one to answer because with our mobile speed cameras, obviously, we move those around. We move those around in response to citizen complaints, and speed is the number one citizen complaint that we receive. So the data there, like I said, we see an increase in this so that the deterrent factor of these machines isn't landing where we want it to land. Mm-hmm. But you can't argue with the reduction in accidents. So we think the data looks great, and we could talk all day long, and this is a conversation that we have at the station quite a bit, is we can talk all day long about stats. The conversation needs to be what we're going to do to change those stats.
Right.
And, this is just one little piece of that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Zahn, you're a Republican. Bobby Kaufman is a Republican. Republicans like to say they stand for local control. Why take this out of the hands of local officials? Shouldn't authorities in law enforcement, together with city officials in Des Moines or Cedar Rapids, best know how to police their speed limits and red lights?
Well, I certainly, as I mentioned before, was a former mayor. I like local control. And it's the job of the legislature to look over what's being done in the state. And I think these traffic enforcement cameras are an abuse to the citizens of the state of Iowa based on, you know, if you're rich, and like, what was mentioned before, you can get as many tickets as you want. It doesn't go against your license through the DOT, or it doesn't go against your insurance. And I just think it's unfortunate. And I mentioned what's going on in Windsor Heights. There was a community in southeast Iowa of a population of 1,300 that they were considering, the council's considering, putting these traffic enforcement cameras on their town square. I'm going to guess there's probably not a lot of accidents around that town square. And so it's troubling, and I think the state needs to come in and certainly make some changes.
Mm-hmm. And I would concur. I would, too, push back against local control argument. For instance, back in Cedar Rapids, in my neck of the woods, Interstate 380 isn't the property of the city of Cedar Rapids. Interstate 380 is a publicly funded entity that everybody in the whole state can use. And also, I agree with Senator Zahn. It is the role of the legislature to step in when local control is interfering with your individual constitutional rights.
Yeah, even though it's an interstate, when it goes winding through Cedar Rapids, that is local law enforcement that has to police that area, right? We don't have a lot of state patrol policing that area, and it is within the city limits, right, Representative
Kaufman? It is, but as I said, law enforcement, while I respect those that are opposed to me, there is certainly a strong support group within law enforcement, so you can't just say this is with or against. There is definitely some disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Sergeant Parizic of the Des Moines Police Department, tell us a little bit how the process works, because you've heard it, and I'm sure our lawmakers have heard it too, that people feel that it's just not fair, this technology making a decision, replacing people, making decision about, you know, you may be able to plead your case. All of a sudden, this picture shows up in your mail. How does the process work for you? Is the police department involved in a review of the picture? What happens? Let's say I speed on 235 in a former time and have my picture taken. What happens, and how is the police department involved?
It's a two-step. Well, actually, more than two-step. I'll tell you how it happened when it happened to me, because I got one on 235.
Congratulations.
And this is how it happened. This is how it happened. So the equipment's owned by Gatso, and we contract with them. The photograph's taken. The cameras are calibrated periodically throughout the year to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing and that the readings are accurate. We give you an 11-mile-an-hour buffer. Some of that is just to just in case that the radar may not be correct or just off a little bit. Then Gatso records the violations. They send them down to the police department where they're all reviewed by a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really review a speeding violation that way. I mean, there's the photograph, there's the car, there's the reading, that's that. The red light violations and the no right turn on red violations, those are reviewed by a police officer, and then those citations are sent out. And then from that point on, there is an appeal process. If you want to appeal it, you can come down to the city and take care of that. The fine is $65 to start out with at 11 miles an hour over the speed limit, which if you got that ticket from a cop, it'd be $168. So I'm not saying it's a good deal. I'm just saying that we've tried to put some thought into doing this fairly and with some equity around. As far as if I comment a little bit on the local control piece, I totally agree with these two politicians when they say, hey, the legislator needs to step in if there's something wrong. And you're absolutely right. If it doesn't pass the smell test, if you're talking about like the city square that you're talking about, or you know, what they call a traditional Iowa speed trap where it's going 55, 45, 35, 25 as you enter into a small town, yeah, that's probably not going to pass that test, at least me as a citizen looking out. But when I look again at the data on the crashes, or I look at the speeds of 105, 106 on the freeway, I think it's worth the effort and worth what little infringement upon that there may be upon somebody's rights to get us to encourage some voluntary compliance to lower these speeds and to make it safe for people to move.
We have just a couple minutes, so I'm going to break in here and get a final word from our lawmakers. Representative Kaufman, what do you envision happening here? And also a quick word about, will there be exceptions? Are areas that are deemed dangerous going to be allowed to have traffic cameras?
You know, I'm in this state house, you can never say that everything is completely final until it's complete and final. Our goal in the House is to proceed with a complete ban. If someone breaks some sort of compelling case where we get nothing or something, certainly I'm willing to listen to that. But the egregious abuse in Cedar Rapids, and by the way, the data is very conflicting. I agree with the reporter when he said that the stop and go is actually making people feel more safe without them than they did. I think that right now in the House, we're going to proceed with the full ban.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Senator Zahn, quickly?
Yes, we're going to have the Judiciary Committee, which I chair. It is on the agenda for tomorrow. My intention is an outright ban with no exceptions.
And do you predict that this will get to the governor's desk?
We definitely have some momentum compared to last year. And it's because of some representatives in the Cedar Rapids area have kind of changed their mind. So there's momentum to pass this. And like what Representative Kaufman said, it's hard to predict. But I think that there's momentum there.
Sergeant Parizic, are you willing to work? Will you be better off, safer, helping motorists stay safe, I should say, in a new environment that perhaps is coming?
We'll deal with the hand that's dealt to us. I mean, we're a flexible organization. We've rolled with things like this before. It's not going to impact how we do business as far as the cops on the street. We may have to make some adjustments is how we're going to deal with some critical spots like the intersections or the school zones where we put the mobile radar, the construction zones. But we'll adjust the best that we can.
Okay, thank you very much. Police Sergeant, Public Information Officer with the Des Moines Police Department, Paul Parizic, Representative Bobby Kaufman, and Senator Brad Zahn. Thank you all for coming into the State House Law Library for this discussion. We appreciate it. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Ambassador Mary Kramer. Talk about her recommendations to ensure a safe workplace at the State House. Perhaps you saw the Grammys last night, white roses on the red carpet, so to speak, at last night's Grammys, signaling demands for better work culture. It's all about that Me Too culture. Ben Kiefer back with Ambassador Mary Kramer in just a moment. It's River to River. Glad to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about RAGBRAI 2018. Perhaps you noticed on the weekend, the overnight cities were announced. And Kyle Munson of the Des Moines Register will be one of my guests tomorrow on the program. Perhaps your city was chosen. Are you looking forward to RAGBRAI this year? Join our conversation tomorrow over the noon hour. Well, white roses worn on the red carpet at last night's Grammys were the latest sign that the Me Too movement continues with demands for better work culture and for consequences for bad behavior. Change is in bloom, so to speak, at our state's capital as well. My guest this hour is former Senate President Mary Kramer, who released recommendations to ensure a safe workplace at the State House earlier this month. It was a report commissioned after taxpayers covered an almost $2 million sexual harassment settlement against Senate Republicans last year.
Mary Kramer. Ambassador Kramer joins us by phone for this half hour, former U.S. ambassador to Barbados and Eastern Caribbean. Also, we should mention, Mary Kramer also serves on Iowa Public Radio's board of directors. Yes. Wonderful to have you with us this half hour,
Thank
Ambassador
you very
Kramer.
Much. It's good to be here.
All right. So reacquaint us with what you were up to here. What was your initial goal going into this challenge?
I volunteered to produce a report that would say what a reasonable harassment policy would look like that would begin the change in culture at the Capitol. To do that, I also had to kind of define the complexity of the management issues at the Capitol because there's no real boss. I mean, everybody, there's lots of teams that report to different people. And then you have all the elected officials who, of course, feel they're only accountable to their constituents.
Well, that's an interesting point, because in that way, it's different than the other areas where the Me Too movement has taken hold and is making demands in business or college and universities or corporate culture. You do have a hierarchy and bosses. And here, you found a different structure.
I did, yes. And, of course, when I was Senate president, I worked in that structure, so I have a really good understanding of how that culture works and
okay.
mm-hmm. or not.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let's talk about the or not. What did you identify as problems? I mean, did you actually interview people? You go back to your old stomping grounds? Did you know the things right off the bat because you had worked in that environment?
Some things I knew from my own experience, and frankly, I was a little disappointed in myself, because when I was the Senate president, I could solve those issues when they came up, had enough influence and authority as a Senate president to deal with a lot of issues, but I didn't institutionalize it.
So if I'm understanding you, you as Senate president, were you a go-to person, for example, for women?
I was.
Who had, and you were known as that, but that was sort of off the books?
Exactly.
Okay. Give me, you know, for those of us who are citizens of Iowa, don't operate in the legislature, how often do you call them those issues, these types of issues surface? How often were you dealing with them?
I expect there would be three or four a session. Not all would rise to the exact level of harassment.
What would they?
But
what would they?
Disrespect give us, yeah. and bad language regarding mm-hmm. groups of people, which really have no place in the legislative discussion. People would say to me, "I have a right to say whatever I want," and I would say that's exactly true. But in this place, when you say inflammatory or discriminatory things, there are consequences. And so we have to deal with that. A particularly vulnerable group, I think, are the pages, who high school seniors, for the most part, who are coming. And it's a fabulous experience for them. I would never want to close the door on the opportunity for people to come and have that experience, because even today I have young people who tell me, who are running for office or who are engaged in public policy, and they were inspired by their experience as a page. So we shouldn't just say, you know, don't do it. It's a good opportunity, but I feel that's a vulnerable population. So we have to pay particular attention, provide training for the group of pages, as well as for the people that that come there and work all the time.
Ambassador Mary Kramer is my guest this half hour. Perhaps you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about improving the work culture at the Iowa State House in light of the huge sexual harassment settlement settled last year. Join us. Perhaps you've worked in politics mm-hmm. in Iowa or elsewhere, and have experienced some of the culture that Mary Kramer certainly has during her lifetime. Join our conversation with your question or comment, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.com. www.mpb.org. You talked about training for pages, for example. So talk about some of the practices that you felt need to be instituted. So pages need to be more aware of what is acceptable and not, and they need to, when the antenna say, this is not right, they need to know what to do?
Where to go, yes. There has to be a clear path to take problems and issues, even questions, you know. And often people would come and say, well, I don't want you to do anything about this, but here's what's going on. Well, in today's world, a person who receives that kind of discussion is obligated to act and to investigate. There is no excuse for just saying, okay, well, I'll just listen, and then I'll ignore it. And actually, there wasn't then either. But that's often people, if there's not a clear path, if there's not a safe place to take these things, then people kind of tiptoe around and say, I don't want you to do anything for fear people will find out I'm the one that complained. Mm-hmm. So retaliation is a difficult issue as well.
How do you tackle that specific one? If you're a young person, you aspire to work in politics, and you certainly don't want to ruin your career, get on somebody's blacklist.
Yes.
So what is the mechanism, the process put in place to answer those concerns, but at the same time protect that person?
Well, while the questions are going on, investigation, because we are a country that believes in due process, so it can't be a he said, she said sort of a thing. But it while that's going on, it absolutely must be confidential. And the person who is designated to, as part of the clear path to receive those complaints, has to be very clear that they do not share who the complainant is until there's a founding reason.
Mm-hmm. So the person who is sort of charged, so to speak, or who is accused of some sort of inappropriate behavior, something they said, they're told of the story against them, and they have a chance to react. That's all kept confidential.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Now, in the private sector, the very best practices would be that you have 24 hours to do that. I think that's because of coming and going and people who don't live in Des Moines, you know, I thought that was, it might be unachievable. But I do think a week is a maximum amount of time that either there are consequences or we decide that it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're talking with Mary Kramer. Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100, talking about how to improve workplace culture, specifically in a political environment, more specifically in our Iowa State House. Let's go to Chris in Des Moines. Hi, Chris. You've been listening. What's on your mind as you hear Mary's assessment of the situation?
Yes, hi. I understand exactly what Mary is saying about the sexual harassment. That is something that really needs to be harped upon. Also, at the same time, racism, discrimination needs to be harped upon too, because that definitely continues to go on at the State House. Not only that, when Mary was also the Senate President, myself, I brought her a report dealing with racism, discrimination, and it said in the report, if nothing is going to be done about the racism, discrimination, this report would just sit up on the shelf to collect dust, then the report is no good. And that's pretty much what the report did.
Mm. Chris, thank you very much. Let's bounce that off Ambassador Kramer. How many did you assess how many had a sexist nature or racist nature in terms of questionable comments or behavior?
Boy, I didn't. And, you know, I've been gone from the State House. I left to serve as ambassador at the end of 2003, so it's been a day or two. But I regret that feels like the case to Chris. I actually am not in a memory that anyone came directly to me with a problem with racism. And so hard to address as policy. And in this report, I would tell you that I said that because of the timing of the national discussion and so forth, that it is urgent that this harassment report gets done, that the policy gets instituted, that training gets done. I'm encouraged because they did hire a human resources professional, and they have hired a trainer to provide training, beginning with the elected officials, which is correct, where it needs to start.
So your report is the first step, and you know better than most as having a person who worked in the private sector as well in human resources.
Yes, I did.
They're changing a workplace culture is not something you do overnight.
No, I liken it to turning the Queen Mary in the Panama Canal.
Right.
But I think it is, the timing of it is now, especially when women report events, they can pretty much be assured that they're going to, somebody's going to listen. And in the past, that's simply not true. You know, I've been in the workplace many, many decades, and every woman that of my age, well, let's even say younger, shall we, and has experienced something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And her choices were, is this big enough for me to adopt the whistleblower stance, which is very damaging to me as a professional?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to stay here and deal with this ongoing, or am I going to quit and find a different opportunity? And that's kind of the multiple choice that faced us in those times.
And that is the dynamic. That's the hard decision. We want to change. We won't.
Yes.
We don't want people to say, oh, I can't do anything about this, so I have to, you know.
Those are my choices.
Is that to shut up or perhaps go somewhere else?
Yes.
Right. Okay, let's get back to our phones. Becky is with us in Oakland. I imagine that's Oakland, Iowa, Becky, right?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. You're on with Ambassador Mary Kramer. What do you have to chip in? Welcome.
Well, I just had, when I heard Mary talking about the he said, she said, and that couldn't be part of the due process because, you know, they would want some proof of an accusation. I really do believe that the predators that are out there or the people that are making these unwanted advances or whatever we're talking about, are going to look for an opportunity where there isn't anybody there, and that's going to be a he said, she said situation. Yeah. Often.
Yeah, let me.
Because they're not.
Okay.
Yeah, I need to correct that impression because I did not mean that it's a he said, she said. I meant that there is an immediate investigation, and even sometimes when it's a he said, she said, it is very clear what the problem is and was and needs to be dealt with. So I think the issue is that every complaint deserves an investigation. And it may not be cut and dried, but especially if there is a history of bad behavior, I think, bad language, bad comments, I think you have to act on it. And in my report, I carefully laid out what I thought were appropriate consequences for each of the groups at the hospital, or at the Capitol,
right.
And suggested how that could be dealt with.
Okay, so take us through that range of possible corrective action depending on the case you are facing.
Well, if it's an employee, it is investigation that would include up to termination. Immediate. If it's an elected official, it's a public filing with the Ethics Committee. And I was very clear that right now the process for filing with the Ethics Committee is not clear, and it must be. The Ethics Committee is used to dealing with financial complaints where somebody got money or took, you know, stuff, tickets or whatever, and this is a different kind of a thing, so we have to clarify what process is there to go publicly to the Ethics Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own experience, I learned the notion of transparency is the most powerful lever you can use with elected officials.
So you are transparent about what transpired. Their constituents find out about that, and then it's left to the constituents to say that's acceptable or not acceptable.
Yes, we either going to ignore it or we're going to say that's not the person we want representing us.
Mm-hmm.
But I also included the media and the lobby because they form a big part of the culture at the Capitol, and if the goal, which I should state clearly, the goal is to create and maintain a safe, respectful, professional workplace for everyone engaged at the Capitol. That's the goal. So you have to have these places to report and channels for accountability.
Okay, I want to get to a phone call, but very, very quickly, Mary, before we do, to what extent have your recommendations been implemented, or do you expect them to be implemented
well,
soon?
Well, I'm encouraged because it will require the help of the HR person to actually get this policy into the literature and get people trained on what. I think it's unfair to exact consequences until you're very clear what the expectations are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this will take a little bit of time. Let's go to Jack in Des Moines as we wind up our half hour with Ambassador Mary Kramer. Jack, welcome to the program. Not much time, but we're glad you're on the program. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. I guess I'm concerned about Ms. Kramer's remarks about mandatory reporting. I'm concerned that if somebody can't come in and just ask about some things, and that automatically obligates a mandatory reporter, that it's going to actually be a disincentive to coming in. If somebody, you know, bumps into me at the copy machine and it happens twice and I'm starting to wonder and I want to talk to somebody about it, I don't necessarily want to have this go run away in the reporting system and turn into a complaint.
Yeah, sure, Jack. I understand that completely. But what do we do in that case, Mary?
Well, that's part of the training for people who receive complaints, that it is, if it doesn't rise to the level of harassment, then counseling or coaching may be the right answer. But you can't just say, I guess I don't like the word mandatory,
mm-hmm.
because I agree with Jack that sort of stifles people's willingness to step forward sometimes. But I think we have to develop enough trust and respect that people are able to say, this happened, I want to handle it myself. How do I handle it? Then let's help that person at least try to handle it. And then if they are unsuccessful, then we need to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you, Jack?
Well, it does, but it doesn't sound the same as the answer we got earlier in the program.
All right. I think it was good that she elaborated a little bit on her thoughts. Thanks, Jack.
Yes. Thanks for the question.
Jack in Des Moines. Let's talk a little bit about due process. You mentioned that earlier. Very important in our country, as it is in our state, and also the national conversation and the reports that you hear across. Do you worry that due process is not always being paid attention to? We have, soon after the first accusation flies, you see it in the press, and then it goes from there, and then there was actually very little due process. Do you worry about that?
Yes, I do. I worry about that, and I tried a good policy in a workplace that is trying to become a safe and respectful workplace is one where you get this time, even if it's 24 hours, to look at this and think it through and talk to the accused as well as the accuser. And if the accuser, and, you know, like Jack's example of being nudged at the water fountain too many times, then would they like to handle it themselves, or do you need to say, you know, you really should look out for this kind of behavior? And it doesn't need to be to rise to the level of harassment. But there are really serious situations where in 24 hours you should act, because we don't want that person to think that is appropriate behavior, and continue it.
Right. We have to go. Mary Kramer, thank you very much for being with us to share some of your thoughts on the report.
I'm happy to keep this in the spotlight, so thanks for that.
Okay, we appreciate it. Mary Kramer, former Republican Iowa State Senate President, former ambassador to Barbados and in the Eastern Caribbean. We appreciate the ambassador's time. And that's all the time we have today. Tomorrow on the program, Kyle Munson, one of my guests, will talk about Ragbri, the overnight cities announced on the weekend. We hope you'll join us, perhaps from one of the cities that was chosen as one of the overnight cities. Share your thoughts on Ragbri tomorrow. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Natalia Reyes and John Pemble.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world,